Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. On this week's podcast, Bill Ballinger joins the MERS team in making predictions ahead of Tuesday's election. Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson talks election security. And we talk short-term rentals with Airbnb's lead in Michigan. Now, here's MERS News editor Kyle Malin, along with MERS' John Roerink.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. Well, it is the day before the election, as we're recording on Monday, November 7. And what better way to celebrate this momentous day than to bring in the state's most prestigious pundit, Bill Ballinger, who is going to be sharing some of his predictions. And maybe I'll pipe in with a few as well. John Roerink will be providing some commentary and some predictions as well to kick off this podcast. Bill, it's good to see you again.
Glad to be with you, Kyle.
John, we just got done making some predictions here at MERS World Headquarters with the staff and our contributors. I was really surprised at how many people ended up making the same picks.
It seems like the people who picked something different was just doing it to be contrarian too.
Imagine that among a bunch of reporters.
Hey, you guys ought to tell me what your predictions are so I can match them, and then we'll all go down together when we're wrong.
That sounds
there
good.
There we go.
We'll put you on our board here, Bill, and at MERS right. World Headquarters. We'll put your list down here. So I'm going to start writing them down. Let's start with the top. I mean, we've got to start at the top, work our way down. The governor, Bill, what are you thinking?
I think Gretchen Whitmer is going to win. The question is, what's the margin? And I'll jump ahead and say I think it's going to be a Democratic sweep for those top three offices, Attorney General, Secretary of State. I think Jocelyn Benson wins easily. The other two are going to be closer. I think they'll get across the finish line. Gretchen Whitmer basically has bought a second term, as you know. Record spending, buried her opponent. And I'm not sure she's going to come out of this with any great head of steam, but she'll win.
I had 53% she would get. John, what did you have?
I had 54.5. And I say that because I still think that none of us have done a very good job of measuring the energy that's going to come with the Proposal 3 and the abortion vote. I don't think we've been able to accurately measure that yet. And I could be wrong. I've been wrong before.
Hmm. You've been wrong, John? I'm shocked.
Yeah. I think Kyle and I predicted that Michigan would never be a right-to-work state. And it was about a week before it went to become a right-to-work state. I remind him of that all the time. Every time we think we know it all, you know?
Yeah.
So what do you think, Bill? What do you think Gretchen Whitmer is going to get in her reelection bid?
Her percentage? Yeah. Oh, boy. I'd be in the neighborhood that you and John are, like 53-54%. That's what I'm thinking.
Now, others have predicted a pretty close race, and there are some polls that have Gretchen Whitmer right at 50%. You know, some that are going a little lower. Why do you think she's going to get to 53?
Well, only because there are enough undecided voters out there in all these polls that it never totals 100% in the predictions. So I think they're going to break, even if they break 2-1 for Tudor Dixon. I think Whitmer's been in the most recent polls I've seen, not all of them, but up around 50-51, and she'll get, you know, a couple of percentage more.
Who do you think is going to get a higher percentage, Gretchen Whitmer or Attorney General Dana Nessel?
Wow, that's an interesting one. I think Whitmer will.
Yeah, I do too.
And that's amazing. I have never seen a Republican nominee, or frankly, any nominee for Attorney General, take the pounding in the media and from all sources for a solid year that Matt DiPerno has taken. And the idea that he could come close to knocking off an incumbent Attorney General, which is something that just literally almost never happens, is astounding, really astounding. And I don't think it speaks well for Dana Nessel's tenure in office so far. I think the pro-DiPerno vote is more revulsion about Dana Nessel than it is about enthusiasm for Matt DiPerno.
Yeah, I agree. I do think that Gretchen Whitmer is going to get a bigger percentage of the vote than Dana Nessel. Do you agree with that, John?
I do. In fact, I think when we did our predictions, I suggested that Mr. DiPerno actually might edge it out. And one of the reasons I think is if you combine Dana Nessel's sort of position on line five, some of the gaffes she's had, she's been kind of carried herself all along as a pretty strident partisan. I think there's enough elements in the water there that I wouldn't be surprised if she lost a very narrow race.
Wouldn't that be amazing with DiPerno having literally no money almost and coming that close or maybe even winning? Just astounding. It'll be one of the most remarkable things. I mean, this hasn't happened since 1954. Frank Millard, the attorney general from Flint, Republican, knocked off. And the Democrats have had an unbroken string of successes until Mike Cox won, and then Bill Schuette, and no incumbent has ever been knocked off since.
Yeah, that is something else. And for Matt DiPerno, he's got reams of opposition research against him. There is so much negative that you could run against him. And he really has flown under the radar with Proposal 3 and the governor's race really dominating all the attention. He's been able to really sneak by without his negatives really being drawn out and being exploited the way they could have been. So I agree. I think that race is going to be very close. In fact, when we asked, we have about a dozen people who contribute to our predictions that we do here in the office. The plurality was that if there was a race that's going to be so close, it's going to demand a recount, it was this one, the attorney general's race, of all the races.
Yeah, I'll just mention one thing more, and that is Tudor Dixon. I think she really comes out of this win, lose, or draw, even losing, obviously, as a kind of, I'm not going to say rock star heroine of the Republican Party, but I think she's a bright, shining new star that the Republican Party ought to make sure it burnishes in the next couple of years and keeps her burning brightly with every possibility of future success. Kind of like, let's say, John James, 2018, 2020.
I was going to say, the next John James, yep.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Because Tudor Dixon, let's face it, a year ago, nobody knew who she was, and that she's been able to make it this much of a race after being buried by like 15-1 deficit in spending is really an astounding achievement. And I think she performed well in both debates. I think everybody sees that. So she's a star right now, and I think it's going to be a bigger star.
Well, let's move on to the next race that we're going to get predictions on, Supreme Court. Now, you can do it individually if you'd like, or do you think the Republican nominees will win, the Democratic nominees, or the incumbents, Bill?
The incumbents. I think Bernstein and Zara will both win. Zara obviously got a big hit in the last weekend here with the accusation of his ex-wife about his paying for an abortion when they were dating, before they were married, even though he voted against putting Proposal 3 on the ballot. So I just think that came too late to have any effect on him. But remember, in 2014, when these guys both ran, Bernstein was a challenger at that point, and Zara was already an incumbent, so he had the ballot designation, and he finished first,
Bernstein was second.
I think it's likely to be the other way around this time, Bernstein first and Zara second. I just don't think any of the other three nominees, whether it's Paul Hudson, the Republican, or there's, I think, a Libertarian running nonpartisan, I just don't think they have the oomph. Kyra Bolden obviously would be the beneficiary of any fall off from Zara. If she comes in second, that'll give the Democrats a 5-2 edge on the court.
Yeah. It's really hard to unseat an incumbent on the Supreme Court, isn't it, John? I mean, it just doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, I was just going to ask Bill what the percentage is in terms of, I can only remember
Cliff
one.
Taylor. Cliff Taylor getting knocked off.
For a long time, there were scarcely anybody that was ever knocked off the Supreme Court. But we've had Curtis Wilder lose here. We had Cliff Taylor, the only Chief Justice in history ever to lose in 2008. So,
what about Alton Davis? Alton Davis got knocked off too, didn't he?
Alton Davis did, but of course he'd just been appointed like 4 months before. He was on the ballot for the first time, so he was knocked off. But he did have the incumbency designation. You're right. So it depends on how you look at this. You can go all the way back to the 60s where Tom Brennan, a Republican, knocked off an incumbent. Mike O'Hara got knocked off at one point. I'm just saying that it seldom happens. The percentage of justices or judges that are defeated is minuscule. It's literally, you know, 3, 4, 5% because they have the so-called incumbency designation beneath their names. And they're the only office in the state that does. No legislator, no congressman, no governor has governor of Michigan beneath their name or state representative beneath their name. Judges do. Most people don't know who they are. They're down at the bottom of the ballot. One third of the electorate doesn't even vote for these positions. And when they do, they'll just go with a familiar name of the incumbent. And they'll say, if we haven't heard anything really bad about him or her, right, let's just vote for him. And they're almost impossible to beat.
Yeah, I would agree. Let's move on to Congress. We're going to go start at the 7th Congressional District, the one here in the Lansing area. Alyssa Slotkin running for a third term in a very new district against Tom Barrett. What do you think's happening there?
I think Slotkin will probably win. I think it'll be close. She's got a huge financial advantage over Barrett. This is one of the most expensive congressional races in the entire country, and it's the most expensive, I think, in history in Michigan. And it could go either way. It depends on whether there is some kind of a red wave that laps the shores of Michigan. That's another big question. Is there a red wave nationally? Does it affect Michigan? Does Michigan escape a red wave? Do the Democrats and heave a sigh of relief saying, well, it didn't hit here. But I think this is one that they'll pull out.
John, I think when we talked amongst ourselves, we were looking at this Slotkin race. There's a few, and I think yourself included, say this is the most likely to be a recount later because it'll be so close.
Yeah, this is the one that I picked for a recount. I think it's good. It's, you know, it's polling says it's really tight. You can tell tensions between those two camps. It's really high. I just think it's going to be an interesting night for those two candidates. Could be an interesting week for the two candidates.
As we were looking ahead, Bill, we looked at the 8th Congressional District with Dan Kildee, and then we looked at John James in the 10th and Hillary Scolton in the 3rd, and nobody had any objections to those predictions. Do you have any objections to any of those?
I don't. I think Scolton and Kildee and James all win.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the State House, or the State Senate, first of all. This was probably the biggest a disagreement amongst the group of 12 of us as to who we thought was going to take majority and where was the, or if we were going to have a split, a 19-19 split. And I got to tell you, Bill, I'm really waffling on this one because I could see it a split and I could see the Republicans with 20. I'm really struggling with this.
You don't see the Democrats getting a 20?
See, in order for the Democrats to get at 20, they're going to need that Grand Rapids seat, and I would think Kevin Hertel in that 12th district. They're going to need both of those, and then also knock off McDonald in the 11th district, and that's a lot of things to go right. So I could see it happening, but that wouldn't be my top prediction.
Well, I'll go with a split, Kyle.
Okay.
This would be the second time in history there's been a 19-19 split. The first one was way back in the early 1970s, 19-19 tie, and Jim Brickley, the Republican lieutenant governor, could break the tie and the Republicans organized. But if that happens this time and Whitmer is reelected and Garland Gilchrist is the lieutenant governor presiding over the Senate can break a tie, just like Kamala Harris in Washington, D.C., in the U.S. Senate, the Democrats should be able to organize. But guess what? They'll never be able to pass a bill in the Senate without Republican defections, or the Republicans can simply make sure one of their members does not vote. And they're going to be short 20 votes, and it'll never get to a tie, and Gilchrist will never be able to break it. So a 19-19 tie isn't all it's cracked up to be for the party that's able to organize because they've got the lieutenant governor.
And you speak from experience because you were a member of that 1919 Senate from 1971 to 74.
Exactly right. And I remember exactly what happened then. A really good story about it you wrote in MERS. I think it was last week. Very interesting. All true. And the Republicans organized, but they realized, you know, they couldn't get anything passed if the Democrats were determined that it wasn't going to pass. Right. The Democrats, by the way, at that time had control of the House. So you had a Republican governor, Milliken, and a Democratic-controlled House, and then you had this split Senate. So it was very interesting. But those were the days when people on both sides of the aisle worked together more closely. There were some maverick Democrats who loved to make deals, and frankly, I think we're just as happy that the Democrats didn't have control of the Senate. They almost got along better with the Republicans controlling it. So it was really a fascinating time. But I think this time around, if it happens, it could potentially be a lot more acrimonious and uncooperative than it was in the early 70s.
And unless, Bill, unless we have a movement to make quadrant meetings great again and the House goes 55-55 and the Senate splits.
Boy, what? That
I mean,
really
that's a journalist's trifecta right there.
That's it. Well, I mean, honestly, you had a so-called shared power in the House, as we know, in 1993-94, and a lot of people think that was the greatest session that, you know, the House has had in half a century. So we can hope for that. That would be a happy result. We could have a 1919 Senate, a 55-55 House, and boy, happy days are here again.
Well,
those quadrant meetings would suddenly get a lot more attention than just MERS hanging outside the
Well, let's just run real quickly here, Bill. So on the Senate, then, do you have McDonald losing re-election then in the 11th district?
You know, I don't. I'll pick McDonald.
Okay.
I'll just say I'll pick McDonald.
All right. And then the 12th district, Hertel or Hornberger?
That's a really tough one. I'll say Hornberger.
Okay. And then 30th, LeGrand and Huizenga.
I'll say Huizenga.
Okay. And then the 35th district with Rivet and Glenn.
I'll say Glenn.
All right.
So you're wondering how they could end up 1919 if all those go Republican?
Yes.
Well, look, you know, 4 years ago, I remember all the seats that Curtis Hertel was aiming at winning in 2018. He only won one of them, Sean McCann in Kalamazoo. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, came like four seats that the Democrats never thought they had a chance to get, like McMorrow, you know, Bayer, people like that. And there could be some other shockers out there, Kyle. These are just the four you asked me.
Okay. All right. So is there a shocker in particular that you'd like to share with our listeners? Because now they're interested. Now, what could possibly be out there where the Dems could win?
You want me to predict the shocker where the Democrats could win?
Yeah.
You know, I think I'll demur on that. I want to hear what John said.
All right, John, what did we have? You had 1919, didn't you?
I had 1919 because I'm rooting for this.
Oh, okay.
This lockup. I want to force people to talk again. I think that'd be good for the state.
All right. So in order to get to
how about Sabo beating Bumstead?
That would be a shocker, but you know what? That's entirely possible. Anything's possible. And you're right. That would certainly move things in that direction.
Yeah. Look, I mean, we're looking at these brand new districts. They've never been run in before. And those are marginal districts. I mean, that district over on the Lake Michigan shoreline, Muskegon and the rural counties, that's a very, very close district.
And I guess Padma Kupa mm-hmm. could beat Mike Weber, and then we're at 1919 if Padma Kupa
there
wins.
There you go. There's another one.
All right. Well, mm-hmm. my prediction are both of those go Republican with Bumstead and Kupa, and I'll say McDonald.
You mean Bumstead and Weber?
Yes, Bumstead and Weber. Bumstead and Weber will win for the Republicans, and then on the Democratic side, McDonald will win, and we may be looking at that Hornberger-Hertel seat late into the night to see if it's going to be Republican control or if it's going to be a 1919 split.
Could very well happen. Hey, listen, there could be recounts all over the state. My God, this may last for days.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think we can underemphasize that, too, because these districts are drawn to be close. And we have so many of them. I mean, we're just talking about the Senate, but in the House, we've got 20, 25 seats that were drawn to be close. And so that's why I've predicted, mm-hmm. John, 55-55 for the House for that very reason.
Well, we had Ed Sarpolis run the 2018 precinct results through the new maps. And what surprised me was that if you do that, the Democrats win control. Now, the vote's not going to be 2018's vote. It's going to be 2022. So you got that difference. But going before that, the common knowledge among pundits was that the Senate was going to be easier for Democrats to capture than the House. So we don't really know what's going to happen.
So what is your prediction here for the House?
I think Republicans are going to retain control of the House.
Okay.
And, you know, I think it's going to be close, but maybe 57, 53, 58, 52, something like that. That's what I think.
Okay. So it seems, so let's just going over some of the individual districts here, and we don't want to hit all of them because there's quite a few, but what do you see happening downriver in the 27th and the 29th? We'll just focus on those in particular. Jamie Churches against Bob Howie in the 27th and Alex Garza versus Jim DeSanta in the 29th.
I will go with Jamie Churches in the 27th, but Jim DeSanta, the Republican, in the 29th. So Jamie Churches is a Democrat, so there's a split right there.
All right. And then we're going to go to the 38th district. The 38th district, do you have any feelings on this one?
Yeah, this is a tough one. I think if... somebody else, George Lucas, had won the Republican primary, he would be the favorite, but he lost to Kevin Whiteford, who is from the wrong part of the district. I'll go with Andrews.
Okay.
Joey Andrews, the Democrat.
And this is that Lakeshore district that goes right up Lake Michigan. It's almost like the ideal Chicago suburbanite district. It's right along the Lakeshore and was drawn as a opportunity for Democrats in West Michigan. So if the Democrats can't win this one, then they can't win anything.
And the funny thing is, if the redistricting commission was supposed to do away with gerrymandered looking districts, they failed here.
That is so true. That is the screwiest looking house district you could ever.
The stepladder district? Is that what they call it?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Something like that.
I think stepladder is a good term for that one. All right, 54th district, we're going into Oakland County here. We got Donnie Steele running up in this one as the Republican, but I'm kind of actually favoring the Democrat in this one, Bill. What do you think?
I'll go with Steele.
Okay.
But I think it's going to be close. Either one could win.
This one, it really kind of turns, to me, it seems like it's a turnout battle as far as what part of Oakland County turns out more, because if it's Orion Township, then I would agree that Donnie Steele would win. But I think Bloomfield Hills, with this abortion vote on the ballot, I think they're going to show up real strong, and Shadia Martini is going to end up be the winner on that one. But I'm with you. I think that could go either way. 58th district is next. Nate Shannon and Michelle Smith.
Smith, the Republican. I'll go with her.
All right. I'm going to agree with you on that one as well. It seems like Macomb County is going this way with John James on the ballot, too. I think that encourages Republican turnout. I think this is a tough draw for Nate Shannon. Too little of his district got put into this. Tough one for him. All right. Going over to Mount Clemens, Denise Mentzer versus Mike Aiello.
I'll go with Mentzer on this one, the Democrat.
And I think I'm going to agree with you on that one as well. I just think that Mount Clemens has still got too strong a Democratic contingent, and she's got some elected experience in a base that might end up helping her in the end. 83rd District, Kent County, the best chance, I think, for the Republicans to win a House seat in the Grand Rapids area, Lisa DeKreiger and John Fitzgerald.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, here's John Fitzgerald, scion of a famous Republican family, including a governor and state legislator and so forth, and yet he's a Democrat. So Fitzgerald's is a great name, but not necessarily in Dutch country. So I'll go with De Kreiger.
Yeah, I think that that's could be a real tough one, too, for the Democrats. And the Democrats have spent a lot of money, and I'm going to go with Fitzgerald just because they spent a lot of money here. But I would not be surprised that De Kreiger wins. When you're talking about those Dutch names in Wyoming, God, that just seems hard to beat. But I'll just go there. I'll just go with Fitzgerald just because of all the money that was spent. All right, and now we're going to move to really, I think, the most contested seat in the entire state in the House, Jack O'Malley versus Betsy Cofia.
Boy, yeah, that's a tough one. Betsy Cofia has run so many times and lost. Jack O'Malley, an incumbent, but in a largely new district. And Leelanau County, of all places, longtime Republican bastion, is now a Democratic county, even though it's small. And the city of Traverse City is now solidly Democratic. So it could go either way, but guess what? I'm going to stick with O'Malley. I think he'll pull it out.
Yeah, O'Malley is the incumbent in this one, even though this district's a little different. But I think I'm going to agree with you, Jack O'Malley, even though, God, I could see that one going either way as well. And we'll finish in the UP, the last bastion of Democrats in are in Marquette, but this is questionable country here. Jen Hill is going up against the Republican Melody Wagner.
Yeah, I think the easy call is Jen Hill. This is the last redoubt of the Democrats in the UP. The Marquette area, because of Northern Michigan University, still a lot of union members up there. But you know what? I'm going to go for a big upset here. You wanted an upset, a shocker. I'll go with Melody Wagner, the Republican, to break through on this one, because Jen Hill is really pretty far out there. Even the current state rep, Democratic Sarah Cambenzi, doesn't agree with her own party's nominee on a lot of key issues up there. And Sarah Cambenzi came into the legislature, supposedly a pretty liberal Democrat from there. And somehow she's been scared straight during her tenure in Lansing. And I think the Democrats are slowly running out of gas up there. They've lost everything else in the UP. This is the last hope that they have. The conventional wisdom says, yes, Jen Hill should win. But I'm going to go with Melody Wagner.
Well, I'm actually going to agree with you on this one as well, Bill. I think that Jen Hill gets into trouble when she talks about Line 5 and not being in support of Line 5 with as many people on propane up there as there is. That's just, I think that's tough. I think energy prices in general scares the dickens out of people up there, and that would be a position that I wouldn't want to take if I was a UP politician. That's for sure. So, John, when we did our predictions earlier for the state house, what did you have, and what was kind of the consensus, do you think?
I think the consensus, if I remember right, was that the Republicans were gonna get it by an edge. I think I had 56 Democrats.
Bold.
Not 56 Democrats. So. That would give them the edge.
Right. But I was not in the consensus of the meeting.
Oh, I see.
Believe it or not, Bill, I don't always agree with everybody in the room.
Oh, my God. You're a maverick, an outlier.
He was the contrarian on that one. I do remember
right.
that. You did pick
I was the contrarian on that one. Although in my heart of hearts, I still want 55-55 and 19-19 in the Senate.
Why'd you say 56 Ds, John?
I'm still going. I was still kind of blown away by that analysis that Ed Sarpolis did with running the precinct data through the new districts.
Yeah,
and I think he had them at 59 based on the 2018 vote. And again, it all depends on how many people in total wind up voting, and we just don't know.
Yeah,
so
the numbers.
To be contrarian, I'm saying 56 Ds.
Yeah, the numbers I had actually show greater Democratic strength in the House than they do in the Senate on paper, really.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of amazed that the conventional wisdom all year long has been the Republicans are in better shape in the House than they are in the Senate. And yet that's the kind of predictions that we're making today. John is the only one going by the numbers, and I can't disagree with him on that.
Well, you know, another number that I thought was interesting, we ran in MERS late this past week, Mark Grubner's numbers on the number of new young female voters who are participating.
Yeah.
And in the grand scheme of things, it's probably a half of a percent. But even a half a percent in a close election could make the difference in some of these House districts. I mean, because you're presuming that most of these young women are voting Dem and they're voting yes on Prop 3.
Probably that is true. And if we've been talking about recounts all over the state, heck, we're talking about half a 1%. So, you know, it could be a decisive factor.
And I think what I said during the meeting this morning, that I don't think we know enough about the impact of Proposal 3 and the vote on the abortion issue on the ballot. I mean, I don't think we know enough to say it's going to tip it towards the Democrats. I don't think we know enough to say, you know what I mean? It's just, I don't think we have a good measure.
Yeah, and you know, I know that Tudor Dixon and the Republicans are getting a lot of attention with their rallies. Their rallies are very good and very well attended. Maybe the Democrats aren't as much, but I think the Democrats are voting early. And I think the air out of the balloon as far as like enthusiasm is being let out here, that the Democrats have voted and they're good. I mean, there's no more reason for them to rally because they've already had their voices heard and they're already in. So I don't know if the incentive to go out to rally is the same as the Republicans, who are more intent on going on election day and showing their strength there. That's why I'm not reading too much into the rallies right now. That's the long way of saying that's why I'm not reading too much into it.
Yeah. On the other hand, you like enthusiasm at rallies in the 11th hour.
Yeah.
I mean, remember Trump, you know, in a huge rally at the, you know, in Kent County at 2 a.m. in the morning on election day in 2016. And guess who carried Michigan? And people kind of draw a straight line between this incredible last ditch rally by Trump in Grand Rapids and his victory in Michigan. Maybe there was no connection, but it kind of sticks in your mind.
Well, very good. Well, Bill, we got to close it up here. This has been a great conversation. I hope our listeners have gotten some benefit. And if nothing else, it's entertainment before the big day.
What about the ballot? What about the ballot proposal?
Oh, my gosh. We didn't do those. All right. Quick. One and two are going to pass, aren't they?
Yes.
Okay. What about three?
I think it'll pass.
And
but
with what
I wouldn't be surprised. I watched this movie before back in 1972. There was an effort to pass a liberalization of Michigan's abortion law then. And all the polls leading up to Election Day thought it was going to win, and it got killed 60-40. And the pro-life forces have spent a ton of money against this proposal, even though the pro-choice forces have also spent a ton, maybe more. But I think the argument that the pro-life people have made has been very impactful, and I wouldn't be surprised if it loses, but I'll pick it to win.
All right, we need a percentage.
I'll say 52%.
Bill, it's been a pleasure having you on. Bill Ballinger from the Ballinger Report, former state senator, former state legislator. And we're going to move on to the next segment of the podcast.
Thank you very much, Kyle and John. Always a pleasure.
Okay, hello everybody. We are here with the Democratic incumbent, Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson. Hello, Secretary Benson. We are currently 5 days away from the election at the time we're recording this. How are you doing? Are you okay?
This is my sweet spot. I love, and I've been doing election administration work for over two decades now. And so this moment, as we get ready for our elections, is where, I traditionally kick into higher gear, higher than even normally. So we're feeling ready. We're very also optimistic that we see high numbers of participation, a lot of enthusiasm on both sides of the aisle to participate in this election, which is a great thing. More people voting absentee, far more than did in 2018. Also a good sign of engagement and turnout. And then I'm also at the same time very sober about the realities of the moment that we're in, which is the midst of a multi-year effort nationally and here in Michigan to really, with lies and misinformation, delegitimize democracy. And in moments like this and in the days that follow, we anticipate and are planning for attempts to interfere or disrupt with the process. But I also know that our team, the Attorney General's team, and state and local and federal law enforcement, we're really more prepared than we've ever been to quickly address any disruptions and minimize their impact.
So I want to make a pivot to the topic of election challengers. Mm-hmm. You had basically a list of instructions, were brought to the courts. The courts essentially, you know, turned them down, had a negative response to them. And I want to ask about the issue of cell phones, you know. So what is wrong with election challengers bringing their cell phones into absentee voting counting boards?
So to take a few steps back, our office has traditionally for decades issued rules regarding challengers under accordance with the law. The most current set of rules was issued in May and was in place for both the May and August elections with no concerns or problems. And then lo and behold, just before an election, a lawsuit is filed. And so we're in the midst of that litigation now. I'm optimistic that as that is resolved prior to Election Day, we'll work with the clerks to know they have clarity on how to ensure challengers comply with the law. So beyond that, in terms of specifics of the litigation, I can't get into because we're in the midst of ongoing litigation and anything I say could impact that. And we're under, you know, instructions to only speak through our briefs to the court in those details. But at the same time, we're working to ensure that however that is resolved, that our clerks and our poll workers have clarity on how to minimize potential disruptions or the from challengers or observers with an eye towards ensuring voters are not intimidated or in any way blocked from participating in the democracy.
So we can't dive deeper into the topic of cell phones specifically, you know, bringing a cell phone in with you, carrying it with you, using it in whatever way that you wish.
For voters?
For election challengers.
So again, that's the subject of an ongoing lawsuit, and so we don't get into details of litigation. But that said, we can certainly delve into the importance of ensuring that voters and poll workers are protected from the nefarious use of any devices to interfere with the voting process.
So given the scrutiny given to the petition signatures earlier this year, you know, that was a huge headline for Michigan. Is there going to be a larger push when it comes to signature verification this year?
We've been consistent for years, even under my predecessor's tenure, as to how signatures are verified and what our advice and guidelines are for clerks to follow. What has really changed is that more people are voting absentee than ever before, but the integrity of the signature match process remains the same. We have several secure protocols in which signatures are matched, and we've worked to provide, again, clarity and consistency to our clerks on how to comply with the law. So we're going to continue to do that, and you know, whether it's, you know, simply putting into writing the very same guidance that my predecessor and others offer to clerks or answering questions as we go along, we think the goal is just simply to make sure we're identifying voters in a valid way and that every vote is then validated through some sort of signature verification process that ensures that only valid votes and every valid vote is counted.
Now, I want to talk about the legislation that was signed by the governor allowing clerks' offices to start the process of pre-processing ballots. There's been a lot of local clerks that have said, you know, we're not going to use this. This won't save us any time. What are you hearing in your corner? Was this worthwhile to sign into law?
Well, you know, we recognize that lawmakers and the governor have their own context in making decisions, but I do think it's a reflection of the need to ensure election administrators are at the table when things like this are discussed or changes to the elections process. The biggest challenge is that it was enacted so close to the election without any funding to support its implementation. And from a realistic standpoint, it makes it very hard to ensure any benefits from the legislation can come to fruition. And that's what you're seeing play out with the pre-processing allowance. Instead of the 7 days that was asked and is the best practice, and many other states like Florida, like Ohio, and others implement. This gives, you know, basically 2 days to some communities with no funding and very little time to set it up. And so it's not surprising to any of us that so few communities are taking advantage of this. We anticipate, and I'm hopeful, that I'll have the opportunity, if reelected, to continue working with the legislature in the years ahead to ensure our laws are in line with other states and best practices nationwide, and to simply ensure this shouldn't be a partisan thing, that our clerks have the time and the resources they need to validate every vote and ensure only valid votes are counted.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk about Proposal 3 of 2018. You know, 2020 was the first large election that this was utilized. Now we're on the second time around. What were the lessons learned in 2020 when it came to this massive use of absentee ballots? And how have you grown since then when it comes to dealing with this influx of people that are taking advantage of it?
Well, I think what we really see is voters were enthusiastic in 2018 and amended their state constitution accordingly to implement a number of new procedures that modernized our election process. We looked at data, and as you may recall, I set up a task force comprised of Republican and Democratic election officials from across the country, who, including former Republican secretaries of state, who implemented these changes in their states. So we followed the data, and then we worked to educate all voters about how to access these new rights, and we were very successful in doing that by the fact that more people voted absentee in the 2020 election, 3.3 million than ever before in our state's history. That also underscored the enormous popularity of that option. Now, our job as election officials is to simply make sure every option that voters have a right to access under the law is equally available and that they have access to information on how to exercise those options. So we've continued to do that, and we've done that effectively, again, underscored by the fact that we have over 2 million or nearly 2 million people who have requested to vote absentee in this year's midterms. So that shows, again, voting early or voting ahead of time is a convenience that voters on both sides of the aisle have embraced and continue to utilize. And our clerk's job, again, is to make sure whatever choice a voter makes, that we're there to ensure their experience goes smooth, that their vote is counted, and they can trust the results of the election.
You know, I have to ask, do you personally vote absentee, or do you like the festivities of on election day voting?
No matter whether I vote on election day or not, there are festivities for me as the state's chief election officer. And I make my decision based on, you know, what my schedule allows. In every election, I'm a mom of a young kid. Sometimes I like to be able to bring him in to show voting in person. Other times voting absentee is more convenient. And that's the great thing. In Michigan, you have the option and the choice in every election. I haven't yet decided in this election. I have my absentee ballot. I likely will vote absentee and drop it off at a drop box in the days ahead. But it's great that under Michigan law, I have that choice and that option either to do that or show up in person on election day.
Yeah, no, my little brother voted for the first time this summer, and he likes it because I'll take him out for lunch when we're done. And he's like, okay, a free meal, a free burger.
You know, there's that. I know for me as a mom, I brought my ballot to my kid the other day and showed him my name and the other names and explained to him the process. So the other side of that is we had more time to just sit at our dining room table and walk through the ballot process, both as a voter, but as a mom. And so I liked that as well. And I'll take him with me to show him, drop the ballot off. And again, you know, I believe the government should meet people where they are and make the powerful act that we all do in participating in electing who has power in the state as convenient and as empowering as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's what our options, that's what we seek to do.
And, you know, obviously there are going to be people unhappy with these election results. And I think 2020 taught us how far some of these individuals are willing to go. Mm-hmm. You know, do you have already an anticipation that you will have to perform some type of audit similar to what you did in 2020? What are you kind of gearing up in terms of verification of this election?
We have consistently done post-election audits that follow the certification process in every election. We certainly did over 200 of them in 2020 at the state and local level, and there will certainly be an audits process at the state and local level again after this election as well.
Now, and I know that you can only share so much when it comes to, you know, security protocols, but what exactly is the protocol when it comes to hostility at the polls and removing it as soon as possible?
Well, look, I think, you know, the law is clear. Voters have a right to vote without fear of intimidation. And voters can interpret what they see as an act of intimidation, and that is what rules the day. And so our job is to make sure if voters feel intimidated or if in any way there's evidence to suggest that anyone in the polls is trying to interfere with the smooth and secure operation of elections, that those individuals are removed. And we've worked with law enforcement, who really are the ones who follow up on what the law is to ensure they know the parameters. And we are working to advise challengers and others and poll workers and mm-hmm. And clerks on those parameters as well, simply so that we all have clarity on where that line is. But the clarity is clear under the law as well, that voter intimidation is illegal, and we're going to stand there to ensure that no voters are blocked from voting.
And there's a lot of cynicism about voter turnout. I mean, of mm-hmm. course, there's a lot of people turning in their absentee ballots, mm-hmm. but Detroit is anticipating maybe even 28%. Mm. Do you think it's the current phase that we're in with voter intimidation, with how the city of Detroit was targeted after the November 2020 election? Or do you think that voter turnout is going to fall back on voter apathy this year?
It's hard to say. I mean, when I talk to voters all across the state, people are really enthusiastic and understand how important this election is and want to weigh in. And there are still days to follow in which many people, I'm sure, will be making that case to citizens in Detroit and elsewhere. I mean, it's true. There's a lot that's going to be decided in this election. It's a critical one. And I think that's why you see so many people connecting with Detroit voters. We still don't know what the ultimate turnout will be, but we are ready to ensure that no matter how many people from Detroit participate, that their votes are counted. But we certainly see as a political strategy of lawsuits like the one currently filed to try to wrongfully invalidate absentee ballots in the city as part of a strategy to discourage people not just from participating, but from really believing that their voice matters and that their vote should be counted. I'm here as the state's chief election officer to stand alongside the clerk and the mayor and say in every circumstance, the law will be followed and every valid vote will be counted. And Detroiters, as well as folks all throughout the state, from Houghton to Hillsdale to Grand Rapids to Flint, should have confidence that when they vote, their vote will be counted, their voice will be heard, and that they can trust the results of the election to reflect that.
Mm-hmm. I know that we're near the end of this interview, but what do you really hope will be the legacy of how this election was conducted? Mm-hmm.
Well, just as in 2020, which was an extraordinarily smooth and secure election, the highest turnout election in our state's history, we hope that that truth and that evidence and those facts remain the long-term narrative around these elections. What we also saw in 2020 was an unprecedented effort to interfere with the process, and that has yielded many candidates who still can't admit the truth about who won the previous election. And so that is another byproduct of a past election that has come to fruition in this one, and I think another aspect of this election will be seeing so many so-called election deniers on the ballot that still haven't told the truth about past elections. The facts and evidence, though, will remain, and our professional election clerks from all parties all across the state will work to ensure that our election is smooth, it's secure, and that the process works for everyone.
And that is Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson. Secretary Benson, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thanks for coming here, and I appreciate the opportunity to connect with you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Join us now on the podcast is Vincent Frilici. He is the public policy manager for the Great Lakes region for Airbnb. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
It's really happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you're a longtime listener?
When I started managing public policy for Airbnb in January or February, I had heard it was a great podcast to listen to, and I started doing it. And so I'm a weekly listener,
well,
but first time visitor.
Great. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, thanks. Born and raised in Flint Township, Michigan State grad, James Madison grad. Was lucky enough, thanks to James Madison, to have an internship in Washington, D.C., which then led to a full-time career in politics and now public policy. And I've been with Airbnb for about a year and a half, and Michigan is the area that I manage, as well as a few other states, state and local public policy for our host communities.
So obviously in Michigan, we have a package of short-term rental bills that I know Airbnb has been involved in as a stakeholder. How would you summarize this package? What's going on here?
Yeah, so the host community in Michigan has really been growing, particularly since the pandemic. Many people now are unleashed from their desks and able to go visit some more and more beautiful places. There's about 30 towns in Michigan that have had their first Airbnb guests since the pandemic. Some of the smallest towns around the state. When we saw the bill that move out of the House in the fall, that was led by various communities as well as the realtors, and the fact that it was bipartisan to create property rights reform, or in some respects a ban on bans, we felt it was our time to then get involved and speak on behalf of our host community for what we would like to achieve. So we're hopeful that maybe, it's my understanding, the discussion on short-term rentals has been a very long one here in the state of Michigan. Of course, as you know, renting out a vacation home in Michigan has been something that families have done for decades. It's sort of in the fabric of the state. And we're hopeful that maybe now this might be the time to create regulatory certainty for short-term rental hosts across Michigan. So we like the package. We're working closely with various members of the legislature on a bipartisan way to create both a tax parity bill that would have our guests pay the same taxes as hotels, as well as sort of a ban on bans, which would be removing zoning as a way to regulate short-term rentals, but allowing localities to use every other power that they continue to have licenses to do it.
Now, so when I hear negative things about Airbnb, I hear two things. The first one being the cleaning fees, and the second, and you know, the second one being the question of what is the long-term impact on this in our country's current shortage on affordable housing? You know, that people can go into a community, buy up a ton of property, and then use it for short-term, you know, vacation rentals, as opposed to investments into affordable housing. I mean, is there a relationship there?
Sure. Well, thanks for the question. On the cleaning fees, the company, first of all, Airbnb started only 15 years ago when our founders in 2008 couldn't make the rent on their apartment in San Francisco. And there was a shortage of hotels for a conference. So they put three air mattresses down in their apartment and they created the website. So the first name of our company was Air Bed and Breakfast. So that's where it comes from. So
But the air was because of the air mattress?
Absolutely.
Really?
Brian, Nate, and Joe couldn't make rent, and they Nate built the website, and Brian ran the company, and Joe designed the sort of the visuals. Joe's a RISD graduate, no longer with the company, but a co-founder, and said, let's figure this out. It was a graphic design conference at the Moscone Center, I think, and there just weren't enough hotels, and some of the designer folks couldn't find ones that they could afford. So they saw a market in a place that San Francisco's, you know, it's a peninsula, it's a smart little place, you know. And Air Bed and Breakfast kicked off only 15 years ago, the summer of the Barack Obama John McCain race. And so we're a young company. As someone who has a daughter who's a freshman in high school, I think about the fact that we at 15 years old, like my daughter, like we're still figuring things out, right? And like she is. And when it comes to cleaning fees, I think we continue to allow our hosts to set those cleaning fees. I know that our CEO and our head of hosting are taking a real strong look at that and making sure that that is done in an equitable way for both the hosts and for the guests. So we're working on that. On affordable housing and workforce housing, we're working on that too. And I would like to say that the studies that we have seen showed a negligible effect on short-term rental activity in the cost of housing, or whether it be rental or ownership. In fact, in the state of Michigan, our host community only utilizes 0.3% of all the dwelling units across the state. Now, obviously, in some communities, that's much higher. But what we also find is that when host communities grow in a very popular place, that markets work. And sometimes when there are too many hosts and not enough guests, the hosts realize that this is not the profitable business they thought it was going to be, and they pull back. That being the case, we would love to find ways to support workforce and affordable housing. And therefore, as a part of this package that we would love to see passed in the lame duck, that creates property right reform by ending zoning to regulate short-term rentals, there is a separate bill that would tax Airbnb guests and VRBO guests or any short-term rental guests a 5% tax. And that 5% tax then would be on top of the 6% sales tax. We've been remitting that 6% sales tax for years. In fact, last year we remitted to the state over $16 million of our guests' creation of 6% sales tax. So if this package were to create this brand new 5% short-term rental tax, we would love for the legislature and the governor to come together to find a way to move 100% of that brand new tax, which we're told could create another $16 to $18 million a year. Just for workforce and affordable housing.
So earmark that tax for affordable housing. So that would be something you would be in support of?
100%. We've done it in other communities. In fact, out in Colorado, there's been a discussion about creating workforce housing for the communities in and around Aspen that service that community with their restaurant workers and such. And in Leadville, Colorado, we fully supported an initiative to use all of the guest taxes in that entire market around Aspen to create more workforce housing. On top of that, again, we feel like we are a negligible, if no, impact on this, but we're sensitive to it. We've just launched a project that's we haven't talked much about yet called Good Neighbor, where we're making grants to workforce and affordable housing groups around the country. In fact, we're going to announce a few of them with our partners here in the state of Michigan in the coming months.
Do you believe that Airbnb, and you talked about small communities in Michigan are now becoming host communities. Yeah. What is the vitalization impact that hosts are having in the municipalities that they enter?
Well, I'll give you an example. Like a couple of the new communities in Michigan are ones that you might not have thought of. Ecorse got its first Airbnb guest in the last year. Clio's gotten its first Airbnb guest in the last year. What we're finding is that people are using Airbnbs and being hosts for Airbnbs in places to serve markets of guests that are not traditional guests for traditional lodging. These are grandparents who want to visit their grandkids, but they don't necessarily want to stay in their sons and daughters' home at night. They want to go over there and want to visit, and they want to stay maybe a few blocks away, right? Or maybe it's a healthcare professional that wants to be as close as possible to where that healthcare facility is, where they might be temporarily working. So that's what we're seeing, and that's what we're concerned about. And while we would love to have property rights reform and the end of zoning, is that sometimes small communities that get first-time guests and have first-time Airbnbs, they feel like sometimes the best way to really react to that is to ban it. And then what happens is after the ban, there's a conversation about creating a license. We would love to have the conversation move beyond just using zoning to ban or picking and choosing winners in a town by saying this neighborhood can do it, but this can't, and therefore someone wins and someone loses. There are communities all over the country that have already found ways to create a license that works for them. And we believe that every community should create that license that works for them.
What's the process for somebody to put their home up for an Airbnb? Like, let's say I said, hey, you know what? I my wife and the kids and I, we're going to go out for a month and we want to rent out our house. Do you guys got to come and check it out?
Yeah. Well, what we do is we walk the host through the entire process, and we're actually launching pretty soon a process to actually make it as simple as possible. What we do is that we do a virtual tour, mm-hmm. and then we also make sure that, of course, the host is abiding by all the things they need to do, like homeowners insurance. And if their homeowners insurance doesn't want to cover the activity, they can use our product called AirCover that we launched last year that provides them up to $1 million in coverage for being a host, as well as protects the guests as well.
Mm-hmm. How simple is that process? How long does it take?
You know, I'm not really sure. I can get back to you on that.
Well, and the only reason I ask is because one of the knocks on Airbnbs or Venmos or
Vrbos.
Vrbos. Vrbos is that they create blight, or there's a concern that these houses will turn into kind of rotating properties that won't be kept up, and that you'll get all sorts of riffraff that will end up coming in and devalue the property around it. What's the pushback on that concern?
Sure, I appreciate that. I think what in my conversations with communities and with members of the legislature, I have found just the opposite. I had a conversation with a member of the state legislature here from the city of Detroit, who told me that that her neighbors in her area that were doing Airbnb activity were the ones that were actually the ones that were fixing up their homes the most. You know, our hosts on average in the state are, you know, they're Airbnb in their homes maybe 40 to 50 nights a year. And we also are fully supportive as we continue to mature as a company and making sure that the activity there is responsible. We usually have responsible hosting pages for our host communities in our largest markets that reminds them of that activity. We instituted a nationwide, in fact, a global-wide party ban about a year and a half ago. And globally, our reports of parties has gone down 44% in the last year.
So what constitutes a party? Something where the cops kind of come in and break it up because there's a bonfire and fireworks being shot off?
It's someone who's being a bad guest. Okay. And that's bad for us. It's bad for our hosts. And that's not acceptable. And what we do is that if someone's actually having that activity, then we remove them from the platform and or the host as well, if they're letting that activity go on. The reality, though, is that as the adoption of the use of short-term rentals grows, it grows with the age of the guest. I mean, our average guest in Michigan now is about 47 years old. The average group visiting a home is 3 to 4 people. And these are families for the most part. And again, we fully support and encourage all localities to create a license. And in fact, we would ask them to consider some of the localities that have licenses that say that if you have 3 violations in any given time period, you lose that, as the person operating this activity, lose that license.
Now, I mean, at the end of the day, and obviously I feel like anyone in Lansing knows this, I mean, municipal leaders like to have the freedom and the ability to design ordinances and to figure things out based off of trial and error and to kind of find the best fit for their communities. So what is Airbnb's relationship with Michigan municipal leaders, especially those that are currently against this legislation?
Sure. Well, we've worked with municipal leaders across the country and around the world now, and we pride ourselves on our local relationships. I think the challenging thing is that we believe in a legislative solution that is not brand new. I mean, the state of Indiana, a border state here, passed this type of legislation protecting property rights and ending the use of zoning to regulate short-term rentals in 2018. And so since 2018, they've had a healthy, growing market, and every locality has gone about dealing with creating their own ordinances, and we continue to help them. I was down in Gary, Indiana, at the request of the mayor just a few weeks ago, asking me to go before a town hall, which I did, of 100 people, to explain, here are the different types of ordinances you can set up, and we're going to stand back and allow them to find the one that fits them. I guess my real concern with the point of view that we're hearing from the Municipal League is that they talk about some of this legislation in a way that would remove all their powers. And the reality is that we're asking really the state of Michigan to join other states like Indiana as well as Tennessee and West Virginia in modernizing their zoning code to recognize what a short-term rental is in the code. And the code hasn't been updated in Michigan since 06, which is 2 years before we were invented. So we'd like to have the code modernized to the world that we're in and to say, you can still use many, many things to regulate this. Please just don't use zoning, because the answer is to create licenses to do that and create the license that fits best for your city or township or village.
What's wrong with zoning, though? Because I can see a municipality saying, we'll allow Airbnbs, but just right here, and we'll just kind of create a little neighborhood of Airbnbs. What's wrong with that?
Well, what we have seen in communities around the country that have done that is that you're picking winners and losers, and you're eventually going to, as a community, have an argument between some people who are on one side of a line and some people who are on another side of the line saying, why is he or she allowed to do this, and why are he or she not allowed to do this? My home is now worth more than his home. There will eventually potentially be a lot of friction about that solution. And so really the way to go about this is to allow everyone to do it anywhere where there's a dwelling unit, but regulate it in the way to make sure everyone is responsible. And we believe markets work. I mean, there's not necessarily going to be places where guests are going to want to go where there isn't a demand for them to go.
You know, this feels a lot like the ride-sharing debate that we had a few years ago, where we started seeing the ride-sharing companies coming in and saying, you know what, this is the way things are going, and, you know, you can either, you know, regulate with us and be part of a trend, or You can be a stick in the mud, but eventually you're going to have to come around.
I don't think we want to be equated with that type of point of view. I mean, I think the reality is that even if there is no legislative passage of an updating of the zoning code and creating a brand new tax in Michigan in this lame duck, you know, we still look forward to working with all of the cities that have major host communities here in Michigan to either continue to update their existing regulations on this or creating brand new ones if they don't have them. So therefore, I don't see it as a binary thing at all. I think it's this is an opportunity for the state of Michigan to really participate and grow its citizen-led tourism economy as it grows and do it in a responsible way. So I don't see it as, I don't see them equitable like that.
You know, just so our listeners know, could you list off the top hot spots for a host in Michigan?
Well, I would say, I mean, our fastest growing areas actually are the smallest rural areas that you would not have thought of, right? Because what's happened is ever since the pandemic, so many people have been unleashed from their desk on top of not just people in southeastern Michigan, and not just people in Chicago, but people all over the country, people all over the world now can work remotely. And this is such a beautiful place. People want to come here, and particularly people that are of the younger set of age want to find that off the beaten path. So I think actually the hottest places are the places that no one's ever thought of. My grandfather, for example, built a cabin on the El Sabo in the 1970s. Near Mayo, Michigan. I think of places like that that have been sort of untouched for people. As long as there's a hopefully 5G cell signal and a really fast wireless service, anyone in a small town who wants to attract remote workers can do it, because all they need to do is have that ability to do the Zoom call from a place that they want to do that's beautiful. So that being the case, of course, the typical places in the state are the ones that we do have the most active communities in, along Lake Michigan, you know, from the bridge all the way down to the Indiana border. Again, the Upper Peninsula, fast-growing community. People love to be up there, people who want to go hike and kayak. But I think the thing that's been really amazing for me is that we've been asking our hosts, I've been trying to get to know our host community. And there's so many people downstate, really, that have these legacy homes. We have hosts in Plymouth, Jessica, who has a place where her parents built it in Houghton in 1982. And the only way to keep it up, right, is to have the ability to host, to pay the property taxes. And she does it about 60, 80 days a year. And so, you know, it's really interesting, it's really dynamic, and it's not just the normal places. I would also say Detroit. I mean, Detroit is a very high demand market for people, and there really aren't enough Airbnbs there. The city doesn't have enough hotel rooms. I understand they're building more hotels, but there's a terrific opportunity to build wealth building in that community by participating in this tourism economy if they wanted to do that. And we look forward to working with the city if and when they want to do that.
All right. Well, we're running out of time here. Anything else you want to say before we let you go, Vincent?
No, I'm just really happy that you had me here as someone who grew up here and whose great-grandfather built a hotel in Caseville in the 1870s and lost it in a poker game, which is a different story for a different podcast. I feel like my life is a little full circle, and I'm grateful on behalf of all of our hosts throughout the state of Michigan that you had us on today.
Well, thank you for being available. Vincent Frelici, he is the public policy manager for Airbnb here at the Mid-Atlantic and Great Lakes region.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Bill Ballinger for joining us earlier, and also Jocelyn Benson, the Secretary of State, for speaking with us as well. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio and Okemos. And also thank you to our sponsors, AT&T. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin for Sam Schreiber and John Rurink. Until next time, take care.